Hey, Robert.
Hey, Ron, how are you?
I'm good. How about you?
I am good, thank you.
So I've been reading about this guy, Brian Johnson, who is, I guess, a successful entrepreneur and made a lot of money, and is now basically devoting his life to trying to extend it, and has basically experimenting and trying out pretty much every idea I think out there with regard to longevity. He's a 24/7 experiment in what works and what doesn't, and or attempts work and what doesn't, and following something called Blueprint, the Blueprint protocol. So it's and it looks pretty impressive. Just reading the stats, it looks like he has he's 45 years old. Just based on a lot of the parameters that are kind of objective, like VO2 max, bone density, and other health measures, he appears much, much younger than his 45 years old. And this was not true 2 years ago. He's been on this protocol for 2 years. But this is really, it seems like all he's doing, he's centered his life around this, which is kind of fascinating. But it's also pretty spooky. I mean, he takes 100 different supplements. 100. He uses all these electromagnetic, I don't know, all kinds of gizmos on all parts of his body, and he obviously does the standard stuff that I think everybody does, exercise and other stuff. But he's obviously experimenting on himself, and this sounds like a one man ingenuism engine.
Right. Well, we talked about longevity, and what we do in our own lives, and it's one of the biggest challenges because it's very hard to evaluate and get feedback on what's working and what isn't working. So it's really cool when people, and I think Tim Ferriss is another one, spend time and then report the results of what we can measure in the short term. So, strength, endurance, blood chemistry, all of these things can be measured. And that gives you, solid feedback in terms of health. Now, how that translates into longevity, we just don't know. But it's a reasonable hypothesis that it could contribute dramatically. And more importantly, living to be 100 is great if you're healthy for 99 of those years, and it's not as great if you're only healthy for 49 of those years. So we might take LeBron James as like the epitome of a physical specimen who's resisting aging, someone who can play at MVP, NBA level into their 30s and maybe even to his 40s. And that's astonishing because the level of eliteness there is about as high as you get on the entire planet.
And it
So,
didn't exist in the past. So there's something LeBron James is doing that is using science, technology, our knowledge of the human body that is new, that is kind of innovative.
that's right. Wilt Chamberlain was a physical aberration, and he retired in his mid-30s. And if he was playing today, who knows? He might have played at the same high level into his 40s because we know so much more now. And a lot of the stuff about what to do and what definitely works in the short term, not longevity, but in terms of health and performance, it has come from athletics. And unfortunately, when you look at the very short term, you start trading off the short term against the long term. If you take, massive doses of anabolic steroids, you can improve strength and endurance, but at clearly what is a long-term health cost. And if you look at the NFL, NFL players tend to die young despite being super athletic in their 20s. So it's very complicated. But the fact that Brian Johnson has essentially reversed his trajectory, LeBron James has been on this regimen since he was in high school. And so the results that he can get are amazing, but he literally has dedicated his life to it versus someone who lived a normal, average, not particularly healthy life that then in 2 years has turned their health around. I think that's something that we all would really want to pay attention to.
Yeah, it's exciting to see, and it's exciting to see kind of the scientific and tech approach he's taking to it. Everything is measured. He follows a clear routine, so we know exactly what he knows exactly what he ingests. He knows exactly what protocols he's doing. Now, arguably he's doing so much all at once that it's somewhat hard scientifically to kind of tease out what's working and what's not. But if it's successful, it doesn't matter that much, although it matters more to us as we would like for Brian Johnson to come back and say, of the 100 supplements I take, here are the 5 that really made a difference. And that would be great for us. It's not clear, well, no, in his case, because it's not clear he's doing that kind of experimentation. But it is amazing. And yet, how does he know he's not killing himself at the same time? That is, I remember a friend of mine, somebody who used to take a lot of supplements, and he used to, at dinner, take out the 20 or 30 supplements he was taking in. And he used to say, look, I don't know, I don't really know, but, half of these are probably killing me and half of these are probably extending my life. If I knew which was which, that would be great, because I'd only take but I'm hoping that the half that's extending my life is bigger. It's a bigger half than the half that's killing me. But there's real risk there, because it could be the other way around, of course.
Yes, and we've definitely seen supplements that seem to provide benefits and then ended up being detrimental long term. But this is the beauty of connection: is there's no way for Brian Johnson alone to answer any of these questions, because it's his individual genetics and biochemistry. It's unclear of all things he's doing, what's contributing what. But as you get hundreds and thousands and then tens of thousands of Brian Johnsons doing things that are each a little different, that's how progress is made in medicine and health and longevity, where you can collapse down the impact of different things with different people and find the common threads, and then start identifying not just what works on average, but what works for different types of people. And while that long-term future, I think we naturally overestimate how big an impact it's going to have in the next few years, because this is a process. But if we're actually measuring things that are correlated with longevity and staying ambulatory for your entire life, then it mushrooms. As you start to learn more, you start to find better places to focus on where you want to learn more. And this is the process of discovery. This is how the world was discovered. People went out and explored, and many of them died, but the ones that found a particular path or route or a pass through the mountains, or then everyone else could build on that. And not only did you continue to grow the total knowledge, but the earlier paths became safe. And that is consistently what we see as technology evolves. And it's one of the things that you and I are most concerned about, is as the world gets, as we get very, very wealthy and satisfied, do we stop taking those kind of risks, which are guaranteed to have costs early on? But then if we don't take them, we lose the massive benefits that show up when things actually get safe.
Yeah, I mean, we see that across the board, this tendency to be afraid. I mean, the fear starts dominating, life, becomes supposedly more precious, but it's a different kind of life. It's a life that is shielded and protected, rather than kind of a life of adventure and some risk taking, because that comes with adventure and excitement. I admire the single-minded focus Brian has in doing what he's doing. I don't know if I could do it. I don't know if I would find it. I'm sure it's interesting and fascinating, but still it's a little single-minded. It's pretty much all he does. But I'm glad he's doing it, because I'm glad that, just like, I'm not sure I'd be the one who wanted to go on that cell ship that was going to go for months out into the ocean. Maybe not for me, get seasick, whatever. But I'm happy people did it, because that's how new knowledge is discovered, and that's how we all move forward in the world out there in terms of our knowledge and our abilities. So yeah, this is kind of exciting. I'm a little jealous of some of the numbers. I'm looking at kind of the stats that he claims he has and what he can bench press and leg press and his testosterone levels and all this other stuff. And it's pretty impressive.
So maybe you're ready to jump in. But I think our concern in terms of this concept generally isn't that there are no longer individuals who are willing to take those risks. I mean, you have people who free climb, I forget the guy's name, but who free climbed Half Dome in Yosemite. You know, that means with no ropes, no.
I'm not sure what I benefit from that either way, but yeah.
but it points to that there are people for whom their calling is to push the envelope.
Yep.
And I don't think that is changing. I don't think that's changed at all, particularly as the number of people have grown. There are more of these people. What I think we're both concerned about is the tendency for the rest of us, or the central authority, to say, no, we're not going to take those risks anymore, to make it either directly through law and regulation or indirectly through the tort system, to make it prohibitively expensive for people to express their own desires to risk take. I mean, you see this when, you know, you've got someone like Elon Musk who's willing to launch starships, willing to risk his own fortune, willing to take a lot of, and then of course all the people who work for him, all the people who are going to go into those spaceships as they start to become man, all of that I'm not concerned about. Those people exist. It's the fact that, you know, when they blow up a rocket so it doesn't land on a population center, and pieces of it land in fields, and then that's used as an excuse to why they shouldn't be launching rockets, because, you know, some stuff comes down into empty fields. Or, you know, pollution. Pollution is a huge problem, but pollution is a problem that gets solved by technology. Yep. Move all manufacturing to outer space, and then you solve pollution problems. And, well, what's it going to take to do that? You have to get to outer space. So having a world where we're discouraging risk-taking, not at the individual level, but as a societal level, that's my biggest concern.
And we know that somebody like Brian Johnson is going to do something and, you know, and kill himself or maim himself or do something horrific. And there's going to be a lot of pressure to stop it, to not do it. I mean, I know, you know, I get the scan once a year where you get an MRI scan but I read online constantly people saying, oh, you shouldn't do that. People shouldn't do that. Too many false positives. That is, they discover something that turns out to be wrong. Too many people can't handle false positives, so nobody should be allowed to do it, right? So rather than leave it up to you to whether you can handle it, whether you can deal with it, whether you're willing to take the risk or not, nobody should be allowed to do it.
So the places where I think this is in medicine is a big problem, where it's really been socialized in sort of every area, every country. The place where it doesn't show up is where people are at risk of dying, you know, where there's a real chance of death, where someone has a serious disease or what's likely to be a fatal disease. And that's when there's much more willingness to take risks, because it's very obvious that the risk of no action is greater. I would argue that that's generally the case, so that should be the default. But when it's blazingly obvious, you get things like, you know, chemotherapy is putting poisons into people to try and cure them of cancer. And when they started, they didn't know what was the right doses, what were the right medicines. They, I'm sure, killed a lot of people. Now, they happen to be people who are going to die anyway. But the reality is that there was no way to get an effective treatment without risking doing harm. There's also no way to get to the next level of understanding the science to get past chemotherapy. So now we've moved into immunotherapies.
Mm-hmm.
And the early immunotherapies they sort of tried to jump pole vault all the way to the end with gene therapy. And that turned out to be too dangerous. It didn't cure, and it basically would reliably kill people. And we didn't give up because the people were going to die anyway. And so then you get technologies like CAR T and more recently the mRNA delivery systems to where the progress is just astonishing. And we're no longer in the realm of where we're doing more harm as the cure becomes more effective. We're doing massively less harm in most cases. And in the cases where it isn't, those are the learning points where we figure out how to actually do it right. It's truly amazing. And we miss in most areas that same sort of progress, what is, you know, essentially becoming magic. You give someone a shot and they get better. And yep. There are almost no side effects for almost everybody. That is essentially magic.
And because it's because they've managed to get the body to cure itself, the body to fight off the disease itself or to fight off the cancer itself.
Exactly. And there it gets even more sophisticated where you inject a catalyst that's going to engineer the body's own immune system cells, usually T cells, so that they'll attack a particular type of cancer. And they've been doing this kind of work for a long time. And what they basically do is they put a double needle into your jugular vein and keep you in the hospital for 3 days while they're taking your blood out and collecting your T cells. And then they take the T cells to a lab and they engineer them and then they put them back in your body. That's miraculous.
Yeah.
But it's nothing compared to we give you a shot. The mRNA delivers it to your T cells. The T cells are engineered inside your own body and the cure just happens. Like that is, and that is where we are. There are companies that are working on these type of therapies. And if you think about every technology that has really moved us forward, you think about, you know, fossil fuels, which we'll all acknowledge have huge downsides and carbon is the least of them. But that they enabled this whole process of discovery. So to look back and say we shouldn't have used sailing ships on the ocean because they were so risky, well, then we never get jet airplanes. And to look back and say we should have never done anything because it was too risky, it's clear now that without that, we wouldn't be where we are. Well, the same thing has to be true going forward.
Yeah, and we live at this really weird time in some senses. On one hand, you've got doctors and scientists and engineers doing magic, whether it's in the human body or whether it's building chips that are unbelievably small or writing programs that bring us AI and the access to the world's information faster and more accessible than ever. And on the other hand, we have this tendency to want to slow everything down and not take risks and stop everything. And these two forces are struggling. And for now, it seems like the forces of progress kind of eke out and they win by small margins. But that's not guaranteed, sadly. And it's always a threat. And we have to keep fighting against that tendency for fear to dominate.
Absolutely. I mean, Facebook right now is working on putting a supercomputer into a pair of glasses. And there have been lots of attempts to make smart glasses and lots of money spent and lots of failure. And that is generally viewed as, okay, this isn't something that's going to happen. But through the lens of ingenuism, that's just part of the process. We are going to have a wearable supercomputer now, whether they're glasses or there's something that's on your forearm that can measure the movements of your hand in a way that you can essentially type on a keyboard and then it's projected on the contact. It will look like magic when it comes, as long as we don't stop these things. And you know, this same principle applies to our individual lives. We can create magic in our lives as long as we keep experimenting and discovering the new things for ourselves. And the challenge for ourselves is that, you know, and Brian Johnson puts it in a particular way. He said, 7 p.m. Brian was the enemy because 7 p.m. Brian would be tired and worn out and depressed, and we just want to eat cookies for 2 hours before bed. And 7 p.m. Brian showed up every day. So when we're working with ourselves, we're individuals, but we also have to deal with the same sort of push and pull. Part of us is, has been engineered by evolution to be conservative, and part of us has been engineered by evolution to be daring. And if we can work out when to apply and how much to apply each of those two tendencies, then we can really live ingenuism to its fullest.
No, that's right. I mean, the model I think of Brian Johnson is not to emulate Brian, but to be inspired to go look for ways in which we can all enhance our own lives as individuals and make them as good as they can be.